Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Yep, it's another showtime for you, all my listeners, and thank you for listening. So there's a bunch of stuff that we're going to cover this morning, and I got some great stories to start it off with. But in addition to the stories, we're going to spend some time really on some international subjects. I'm going to go over some headlines with you, because the headlines kind of tell you the crazy, loony, dangerous stuff that's happening in the world. And the articles are posted, as always, on the website. That is ontherightsideradio.com, www.ontherightsideradio.com. I'm going to ask all my new listeners to go to our Facebook page and throw us a like. I'd sure appreciate it. And I'm going to ask all you listeners to keep us going on the increase of our reach, which has been absolutely phenomenal over the last 6 months to a year. Phenomenal. We're now up to 1.3 million listeners. Unbelievable. The huge majority, by the way, or at least the great majority, on podcast and on this and on the website, which is terrific. It's the changing face of communications, the rapidly changing face of communications. Do you realize that just 3 years ago, the majority of our listeners were on AM radio? That is how rapidly technology is changing things. It's incredible. So, we're going to talk this morning about the Obamacare rhinos. All those so-called Republican, so-called conservative senators who have an R in front of their name, who are liars, flat-out liars. And at heart, establishment, entrenched Republican progressives, probably with links to the deep state, although I don't know that, but absolutely positively establishment, anti-Trump, anti-populism, anti-nationalism, pro-globalism, and particularly, like some of their Democratic counterparts, pro-themselves, power and money. So I'm gonna name names, and I'm going to give you some quotes of each of these people and then how they voted. Seven Republican senators. Unbelievable. And, you know, there are already PACs, political action committees, forming to get rid of these guys at the and girls at the primary level, just like I forecast would happen 2 to 4 weeks ago. The first PAC, in fact, is already sending out solicitations for funds to fund candidates, real conservative candidates against these senators. I'm going to be sharing that with you because you should contribute to them. None of these people deserve to remain in office. Zero. Not one of them. We're going to be talking also this morning about the incredible, the avalanche, the tsunami of revelations about Democratic corruption. We all knew it. But now there's some facts coming to light that I'm going to share with you, which it probably is absolutely the most succinct summary of what has gone on in the last week in terms of revelations, if you will. You know, they're not revelations. Let me correct that. We all knew what was going on with the Democratic Party. Susan Rice, Ben Rhodes, Barack Obama, Valerie Jarrett, Hillary Clinton, John Podesta, I can go all the way down the list. We knew what was happening, but now the facts, that is emails, that is communications, that is other dots, are all coming to light. And we're going to talk about the fact that the House Judiciary Committee finally I mean, hey, folks, where you been? Is starting investigations into this stuff. And just as I predicted 7 months ago, and I talked a little bit about this on last week's show, I think there's probably a 70%, maybe even 80% chance there will be a special counsel appointed to go after these people for a whole bunch of things, which I'm going to talk about very briefly this morning. More important is the facts which have come to light and the incredible collusion between these people within themselves and the deep state. In addition, if you remember, 2 years ago, give or take, I am, if not the first, one of the very first to warn you about the deep state. In fact, I read an article on that show several years ago by a guy by the name of Doug Casey. Absolutely terrific. And I don't read people's articles in full often. In full means it was about two pages, so I mean, it wasn't the bulk of the show. But it is fascinating. So 2 years ago, I was warning about the deep state. And what happened this week, I think it was kind of the coup de grace, if you will. It was the coup de grace of the deep state showing its face. And that is the leak of the transcripts of the communications between Trump and the Mexican president and Trump and the Australian prime minister. And I don't need to tell you how damaging that is to America. I think that Donald Trump, and I've talked about this on previous shows, not only did he force the progressives kind of out of their alt-left closet and into the streets at Berkeley and a million other places in Middlebury and you name it. Not only has he turned them into wackos, which is evident to like everybody who has a brain in the United States and the planet, other than themselves, because they're in their own little bubble. He also got the press and their bias and their lousy reporting and their selective display of so-called facts and their fake news. He brought them out of the closet. And now what he's done, and I really think that this was the turning point, the leak of those two conversations. Now I think what he's done is he has forced the deep state out of the closet. They have now kind of fully revealed themselves. I don't think there can be any argument that some percentage, probably small, particularly of the intelligence community, but certainly of the bureaucracies and many agencies from DOJ to DHS to, you name it, EPA, even though they're being weeded out, there's no question that there's an entrenched bureaucracy which is hostile to change, hostile to any infringement on its power, anti-constitution, pro-globalism, and willing to subvert the will of us, the American people, with antics which put all of us at risk, and I'll explain that later in the show. First, I'm going to tell you a story or two, because everybody likes a story or two to start off. So, you know, I am on a little mini book tour, which the publishers have set up for me, and I had a terrific 3 days down as a designated author of Buffalo Bill Days in Golden, Colorado. I think it's our fourth year as designated author down there. Saw lots of old friends and readers. Got pitchforked at least 20 or 30 times by readers who wanted to know where the hell is book four. And I can't blame them. I'm going to talk about that a little bit at the end of the show. And it was great seeing everybody. Just terrific, terrific folks. And I believe the publisher is publishing pictures and stuff on social media, if you want to check out the Threads West Facebook page, etc. And now, after one day back at the ranch, I mean, this has been kind of a grind. 3.5 hours back from Golden to the ranch, and then like a partial day, I got in about 11 or 12 at night, and then had to leave the next day for Sydney, Montana, and the Richland County Fair, which doesn't sound like much, but is terrific. Very large fair for a county fair, packed to the gills with great folks. Sydney, I have not been in this part of Montana before. It's kind of the northeast corner of the state, or pretty close. I think we're only 180 plus or minus miles from the Canadian border and not too far from the border of North Dakota, so that'll give you an idea. And they've been suffering a huge drought up here, poor folks. I mean, there's nothing worse than having several thousand acres of dry land crops, wheat, grains, whatever have you, or pasture lands for your cows, and seeing it dried to a crisp. In fact, the very first rain they got, like in the last 4 months, was the day after I arrived, the first day of the Richland County Fair, which is only a four-day event. But I will tell you that the fairgrounds are absolutely immaculate, very spacious. They are not crowded and bustling and dirty like the big city fairgrounds in many areas, or big city events in many areas, never mind fairs. Very well run, a smaller number of vendors than you normally see in these types of things, but all terrific people and all pros at what they do and offering great stuff. I mean, you know, these fairs are kind of like the cauldrons of basic entrepreneurialism in the United States. It's terrific. Everybody has certain things that they're selling or that they're pushing. Many of them are made by themselves. You know, they're not kind of stock product, if you will. Some are. But even those products are terrific. And the homemade stuff, the handmade stuff, is absolutely phenomenal. And the same is true in Golden. Just tremendous artisans. I mean, if you folks don't go to these types of events, if you don't go to your county fair or your state fair or whatever have you, those types of events around you, you're really missing out on something. You're missing out on a really fun day. You're missing out on calorie-laden but delicious fair food. It's kind of its own menu, its own cultist menu of foods. There's funnel cakes and there's all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's a riot. And the people are, particularly in these smaller town get-togethers, absolutely terrific. And the people in Golden, I consider kind of a small town, are terrific. So it's been a big treat and kind of a surprise. We have never been the designated author up here before, but we are delighted to be so this year. And the books have been literally flying off the shelves. I mean, it's been really phenomenal. Very well received and a lot of word of mouth, and it's been great. So here's my stories, if you will, related to my travels and my observations here over the last 10 days of being a masochist, a book-selling masochist. How's that? An author book-signing nut. And you got to be nuts to do this. First of all, I will tell you that I talk to a lot of people. I've said this on previous shows, and I was, along with Sean Hannity, literally the only commentator to say, like the day Trump announced in 2015, that he would be the next president of the United States. And I never wavered in that, although sometimes I was a little nervous. So, I talked to, at these various events, whether they're book signings at Barnes & Noble's, in Idaho, and Utah, and Colorado, and Oklahoma, and all the places the publishers send me, or these big kind of events, the Wyoming State Fair, we're going to be at the Nebraska State Fair in a couple weeks, we're going to be at the Central States Fair in Rapid City, South Dakota, both new events for us, both new places that we're designated authors, And we're going to have some appearances in Texas, by the way. You Texas folks who have been hollering at me to get down there in February and March, it looks like. But I'll, there's more on that later. So in my travels, I talked to many, many, many people. You know, at the beginning of each year, the publishers print up for me 25,000, that's 25,000 business cards. And at the end of the year, I can basically count what's left and know, give or take a few hundred people, that publishers' assistants who assist me at some of these events may have passed out. I can tell you how many people I've talked to. Because unless I've talked to them, they don't have a card. That's just that simple. I don't airdrop them. I don't scatter them around the floor for people to pick up. I don't drop them out of the truck at 70 miles an hour hauling butt along the interstate. I talk to somebody. I look them in the eye. I hand them a card. And in doing so, I can gauge people. And many times I engage people. And I get to know what they're thinking. I get a sense of their energy. I get a sense of, how do you term it? I get a sense of their aura, if you will, about their current state of life, about how they feel about their family and their work and the country and politics. And, you know, one of the ways I knew that Trump was going to be elected was between mid-2015 and fall of 2016, the election, I had given out about 20,000 cards. I had talked to 20,000 people in, I think, five or six states at who knows how many events, from bookstores to Buffalo Bill Days, where we're the designated author, to county fairs and state fairs and all sorts of places. In any event, this year, my book signings really started with Buffalo Bill Days in Golden. And that was just, what, a week or 10 days ago. And I started off with my 25,000 cards, some of which I had given out here, there, yither, and yon, but not many, maybe a couple hundred. And I have given out in 6 days of book signing at these two events, I've given out close to 1,500, that's 1,500 cards. 1,500 people I've talked to, young, old, heavy, trim, gals, guys, ranchers, businessmen, bankers, unemployed, you name it, cowboys. And you know, when you do that, you get a pretty good cross-section of people. And it's the cross-section of people in flyover America. It is the cross-section of people who are the backbone of this country. It is the flavor of people who still, for the most part, there's always exceptions, harbor American values, are fiercely proud of America and her manifest destiny, and are mostly pro-Trump and pro-Trump policies. Certainly pro-Trump policies. I don't think I have met in all these signings more than 100 of those 1,500 people who I would consider left-leaning or progressive. Quite the contrary. So you get a pretty good flavor of where the red states, flyover America, middle America, working America, whatever you want to term it, how they feel. And I will tell you that in my discussions with people, they are greatly relieved that Hillary Clinton did not win. They are relieved that the Democrats do not control either House of Congress. But they are really pissed, folks. They are really pissed about a number of things. And I think they're more angry now but in a focused way, than they were, than those 20,000 people, 19,900 of those 20,000 people I talked to between mid-2015 and mid-2016, and which told me Trump was going to win. You don't talk to 99.9% of 20,000 people in six states, feel their anger and frustration, and come away with any conclusion other than there's going to be a big change. It's just impossible to reach any other conclusion, and that conclusion was correct. And the conclusion I've come to after these 6 days of signing in Denver, Colorado, or Golden, Colorado, and Montana, is that people are relieved about many things. They believe the economy's getting better. They believe regulations are getting rolled back. They believe that the administration is getting lots done in dismantling the progressive crud that has been erected for the last 30 or 40 years at an accelerated pace under Obama, of course. So there's many things that they feel good about. But they are really pissed at Republicans in Congress for not getting stuff done. They are really, really upset. They are upset with these rhino Republican senators I'm going to talk about tonight. They are not happy at all with many of the congressional representatives who, like the rhino Republican senators, told them one thing and did something else. And they are not happy whatsoever with what they perceive, and rightfully so, as an attempt to undo the election by the deep state with its completely fraudulent Russia Trump stuff. And they are super angry. I mean, boiling mad that the machinations, the fraud, and the corruption, and yes, the felonies of many in the Democratic hierarchy, you know, of many of the progressives, Hillary, Rhodes, Rice, Podesta, I mean, once again, the list, is going, in their minds, unpunished, uninvestigated, and unaccountable. So I'm going to stick with my predictions, because I think that this sample of middle America is going to translate into pressure, even on unwilling so-called Republicans, to kind of get their heads out of their boots and to get something done, to gear up not only the investigations of these criminal activities, and in some cases treasonous activities, by progressive Democrats, but also to get a special counsel appointed to go after them. So I'd say the chances are about 70-30 that you will see a special counsel for all the Dems, or should we say, to investigate all the Dems. And I'm going to tell you, I bet you it's 70% or 80%, I'm going to talk more about it here later in the show, that you will see indictments come out of that special counsel against Susan Rice, Ben Rhodes, who, by the way, was just named this week as a person of interest. I've been talking about him getting involved in this morass for months. If you've been listening to my shows, I use his name all the time, even though nobody else in the media was saying Ben Rhodes. Ben Rhodes is the guy who wrote that scurrilous and knowingly incorrect and fraudulent Benghazi report that blamed it on the video that Hillary then used and Rice then used and Obama then used. I mean, he's a frustrated novelist. There was an article on him about 6 months ago that I talked about a little bit about on the show. And you should read that article. He makes some incredible admissions in it. Incredible, really. I mean, basically says, yeah, You know, I put together stories that we use, and, you know, the American people are too dumb to know the difference, so that's what I do. It's the typical opinion of the elites, right? All these people that I talked to in the last week, whatever it was, those 1,500 people, to the elites in Washington, to the entrenched members of Obama's bureaucracy in the deep state, we don't mean squat. We don't exist. We are not worth their time. Our opinions don't matter. And we don't have the brains to figure out anything. You know that, right? Of course. That's why they lost the election. That's why, unless the Republicans screw it up by not being Republicans, they're going to get their butts kicked in 2018. There's not going to be any Democratic tsunami so long as the Republicans act like Republicans. Now, that's kind of the prelude to my two stories. So, first of all, you know, I get into Sydney and go down. I'm setting up at the fairgrounds and all that kind of good stuff. I meet a lot of the vendors. I really did not meet a single person, which is amazing, that I didn't, you know, not like. How's that? And I don't mean dislike. I mean, you know, I didn't meet a single person that I didn't feel genuine warmth from when we said hello or shook hands or introduced ourselves and what are you doing and what are you selling and where are you from, etc. The usual stuff. Only one person at the Sydney Fair has, shall we say, have I found slightly irascible. How's that? I will be so PC here. So we have vendors, you know, around us, around our signing station. And I think there's like four vendors, which I would call direct neighbors. How's that? Either right across from us, or because we're in a corner, right across from us, or one way or the other, or next to us, whatever it happens to be, catty corner from us. And all of those vendors, with the exception of one, have been terrific. In fact, all have purchased books, and I've signed them for them. One vendor bought three sets. One for herself, one for her hubby, and one for Christmas presents. And they have terrific stuff. In fact, I have a magnetic deal that I bought because, I don't know, maybe it'll help with my back, which is a product, or shall we say my back, which is somewhat less than my back used to be, a product of being young and dumb and riding bulls and wrestling and extreme skiing and all that crazy stuff. So I bought this little magnetic thing, so I'm going to see if it works. Anyway, to shorten up this story, one of the fair administrators, all terrific people, the fair staff is just great. I mean, really, it's really a very pleasurable gig, even though long hours and hard work. One of the fair administrators came up to us and said, you know, you really have to kind of stay inside your space because, you know, you're interfering with the traffic flow to the other vendors. And, you know, I kind of looked at her, and I didn't want to get angry, but I had no idea what she was talking about. Because the way our signing space is set up, we kind of have our outer tables. You have to have a place to sign books, and you have to stand in front of those tables. And the aisles are very wide. They're probably 20 feet wide. I mean, they're not narrow at all. And the whole space is kind of open. So there's no way you can infringe on any spaces. One vendor, which is our neighbor, had not had much to say to us. And of the four or five vendors, which I would call direct neighbors, seemed to be kind of doing less business than everybody else. And, of course, we've been very, very, very busy with the books. And the vendors in the other locations who are direct neighbors have been either quite busy to very, very busy with the stuff that they're doing, except for this one, who has been, at best, moderately busy. How's that? And for all I know, they've sold the crud out of what they got going. But just my observation. And, you know, I was very surprised at this administrator, and she was very nice about it, and I explained to her, listen, there's no other way to do this deal. You know, we can't be inside the tables because there's no way to sign books. We can't have people coming in. We have to kind of, you know, stand out where the books are. Otherwise, we can't pick them up and sign them for folks when they come up. But we will limit ourselves. We will not, you know, we'll try not to move 2 feet from our tables. But I have no idea what you're talking about interfering with other vendors. And I took the opportunity to go over and gently ask my other neighbors, you know, do you have a problem with the way we're kind of running our book signing over here? And all of a sudden, what are you talking about? It's great. We like watching and talking to people, and everybody's laughing, and they're signing books. It's terrific. We love having you around. You're bringing in lots of traffic. Which kind of narrowed everything down after I did my quote-unquote sleuthing to the one vendor who I kind of described as not doing, in my opinion, as well as the others. But I kept my mouth shut, and we tried to limit our wanderings, if you will. I mean, 3 feet from our table. We tried to limit our wanderings, and sure enough, one of the people in this other vendor space today, in fact, quite to my surprise, kind of leans over the partition between us and kind of gets in my face about how we were interfering with them. And by the way, the product that they offer, there's no interference whatsoever. It's a kind of a sit-down presentation. You know, there's just no way to interfere. I mean, people are going to that specific spot to sit down and whatever. And I tend to think that we generate traffic rather than divert traffic, but that's my opinion. Anyway, that was the only exchange in this whole trip up here, 6 days, that I had that I found at all unpleasant. But the moral of this story is that obviously this vendor, without the courtesy of talking to their neighbor, us, and saying, hey, could you do this or that, or this is having this effect, or this is having that effect, which we would have been very cognizant of and done everything in our power to either diminish or alleviate. This vendor instead went to the fair staff. And, you know, I have a problem with that. I have a problem with somebody who won't deal with you eyeball to eyeball. I have a problem with someone who goes around your back. And I have a problem with someone who uses authority as a first rather than a last resort. In any event, I believe the situation has been straightened out. But you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of, guess, oh yeah, the leakers. The guys who don't go to President Trump and the administration and say, hey, I don't like your policies. I don't like what you're doing. Here's my suggestion, et cetera, et cetera. These are the people who instead take the transcripts of conversations between heads of state and give them to the Washington Post, which is owned, by the way, by Jeff Bezos from Amazon, a radical progressive. And he has, do you ever notice how all the radical progressives have lots of money? Have you noticed that? All the leaders in the Progressive Party, and I'm not talking about the street gangs who break windows at Berkeley. I'm talking about the high mucky mucks, the high mucky muck progressives, Obama, Jarrett, Podesta, Clinton, they all have lots and lots of money. One more reason they really don't care about you. They just want more money. They want more power. But it reminds me of the leakers. The leakers don't do the frontal assault. The leakers do the behind-the-back assault. Now, unlike the Sydney Fair, where it's a momentary hiccup, and in the end really doesn't mean a lot to either us or our complaining neighbor, and certainly not anything to the other neighbors, those leakers, folks, by doing what they're doing, by going to the press with fake news, false news, partial news, confidential information, classified information, they put us all at risk. They put our actual lives at risk. They put the Constitution, particularly the Fourth Amendment, at risk. They put the rule of law at risk. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that here when we get to the second segment of the show, which is these amazing revelations that have come out this week. So that's story and moral number one, and the tie-in to what's happening on a national scale. I guess there will always be people who simply don't have the guts, the courage, the fortitude, or the moral turpitude, you know, the morality, to do things eyeball to eyeball before going to the next step. It's not something I respect. Now, let me tell you story number two. So story number two is, I took a break from the book signing today, and it was a pleasant day, a little hot, muggy, bit hazy, kind of impending cloud line on the horizon, which might bring, again, I hope for all these folks up here, some much-needed rain. And I went outside. There's a door near where the signing station is. And I went outside, take a short break, check the phone, you know, just do my little 10-minute clear my head before I go back inside and sign more books routine. And while I was out there, there's a little foyer you have. There's three or four foyers. They're not so little. I guess they're maybe 20 by 20. And there's fair staff at a table in each of the foyers. Absolutely delightful people. And they check to make sure you have your fare button or your fare wristband or you're paying your daily admission, whatever it happens to be. And I was kind of opening the door to go back inside. And there was a young gal there, I don't know, 20, 21, 22, somewhere I think in her early 20s or thereabouts, with two little kids. And they were probably 3 years old maybe, or 4 years old, one of them, the girl. And the boy was, 4 or 5 years old, maybe a couple years apart, cute kids. And mom was at the admissions table, and she was digging kind of frantically in her pocketbook, and the kids were kind of, you know, they had their hands kind of on her jeans, and they're kind of looking up at her like with questioning faces, like they didn't really understand what was going on, and it was obvious she didn't have the money to pay the admission to the fair. It was obvious. I mean, you could kind of feel the vibes. And she walked out the door as I was kind of walking in, and I had kind of witnessed all this. And the gal from the fair, kind of manning the entry table, if you will, kind of looked at me and shook her head sadly, kind of corroborating, you know, the energies I had picked up on. And the mom went out and said, "Oh, well, I'll just go find an ATM. And I walked back out the door just to see where she'd go. Because I had this funny feeling an ATM isn't what she was looking for. And an ATM is not something that would have helped her, because I don't think she has any money in her ATM account. And I kind of loitered around that door. And, I think I was sipping on a chocolate milkshake or something. And she went over to a bench and sat down and was rummaging through her bag. And it was obviously she was looking for some money. You know, maybe some money had fallen into the bottom of her handbag or something. She wasn't going to any ATM that I could see. So I leaned my head inside the door and talked to the fair gal who was manning the table, who, terrific older lady, just wonderful. I talked to her and smiled at her and yik-yacked with her every time I went in and out. And said, how much is it for them to get in? And she looked at me and shook her head a little bit. She goes, $4. $4, folks. So, you know, it just kind of struck me that this was a moment for a good Samaritan. And I leaned my head out the door and I called out to the gal who was probably, I don't know, 50 yards away, 30 yards away, sitting on this bench, still rummaging through her bag. I said, hey, let me pay for your entry fee. She said, oh, no, oh, no. She looked at her kid. She goes, I'll just go to the ATM and get some cash. But she didn't move to go to the ATM, which was down at the end of the building. I said, look, just my pleasure, let me do it. So rather reluctantly and a bit embarrassed, she said, okay. And she came in, and I gave the $4. $4, folks. There's a moral to this story. I'm getting there. I gave the $4 to these folks, and they got in, and I turned around to the little kids, and mom told them, say, thank you, give them high fives. So they gave me little high fives. And I said, listen, I'm doing this for one. Here's the deal. You guys have to have a lot of fun. And they nodded their heads enthusiastically with big grins, and I could almost see the relief in her face. So it was great, you know. For $4, I kind of changed kind of their whole day. And I don't know, maybe more, who knows. But in any event, it didn't have any detrimental effect. And the fair lady said that was very nice, and, you know, I said, thank you, and I walked in. There was another vendor out there kind of seeing me. She goes, yeah, boy, that was a great thing to do. And I went, you know, it was $4. There's a couple morals to this story. I'll probably never see those people again. I'll never see those kids again. Hopefully, and I'm not looking for any kudos. I mean, folks, it was $4. Think about that. Think about what a small amount of money $4 is in today's world, right? It wouldn't buy you a pack of cigarettes. It'd barely buy you a coffee, even at a local coffee shop, because I hope you're not going to Starbucks. And such a tiny, tiny, tiny little thing. But obviously a tiny little thing that meant a lot to those kids and to their mom. And it struck me that if all of us did one little thing like that, not for kudos, not for slaps on the back, number one, it would make you feel better about yourself. And number two, just the tiniest little gesture like that can change an hour, or change a day, or change a week, or change a month, or change a life. And I'm not saying my $4 in their afternoon and evening at the fair changed anybody's life. That's not my point. My point is, small acts of kindness to people who need something and are incapable of doing it for themselves are good things. And you know, on each little bit, $4 at a time, whatever it is, maybe we can put this country back together again after the progressives have rendered it tried to render it, into pieces. I don't think they've rendered it into pieces yet, but they sure cracked the eggshell, if you know what I mean. you know what I'm saying, with their politics of division and resistance and nonsense. So those are my two stories, and I hope those two little kids had a great time and their mom had a great time. And I'd like you to remember this next time you see somebody who, you know, I don't know, you're in a checkout line at the local grocery market, and there's somebody, I'm sure you've seen it, I've seen it, somebody's digging in their pocket trying to find that last dollar to buy that grocery item so they don't have to take it out of their bag. You know, throw in the buck for them. Whatever it happens to be. Anything like that. All right. So, that is my, or those are my two stories for tonight. And you know, that kindness thing, that helping people out thing, which is really nothing, right? It was for me, in this particular little instance, it was $4 and, I don't know, 60 seconds of my time, I guess, whatever it took to tell her I'd take care of it and, you know, peel off the $10 bill and get change from the great gal that mans the table. So think about that, because every single one of us has opportunities to pitch that little something in that changes a situation for someone else that they're unable to change for themselves. And it's noticed. And I think it's a little drop, a tiny little drop of glue on the whole of us as Americans. All right, I've waxed poetic and philosophical long enough. Let's get into the show. First of all, we're going to talk about these Obamacare rhinos. I mean, these Republicans make me wretch, folks. I think they make me wretch more than the progressive Democrats, because the progressive Democrats, I know who they are. These rhino Republicans are supposed to be conservative Republicans who, and listen, if they think they can do something better, they have an amendment to offer, or they can, you know, there's something specific for their constituents they need to get in a bill, I understand all that. But when they lie to America and they lie to their constituents, I have zero tolerance for that. I have as little tolerance for that as I do for people who don't talk to you first, who don't do an eyeball to eyeball before going to the next level. So you see, this whole show kind of ties into those stories. So let me give you some unbelievable quotes and then how they voted. First of all, Lisa Murkowski, the Republican so-called senator from Alaska. Alaska, folks, has extremely high Obamacare premiums and is down, like Wyoming, to one insurer. No choice. If you want Obamacare insurance, this is your insurer, this is how much you will pay, this is the policy you will get, which is mandated by the law. In other words, if you're a 70-year-old man, you'll have to buy maternity coverage. This is her quote, and this was just before the election in November 2016 that she was struggling to keep her seat of power and money in. Quote, "This law is not affordable for anyone in Alaska. That is why I will support the bill that repeals the ACA and wipes out its harmful impacts." Lisa Murkowski voted against repeal, folks. Dean Heller, Republican so-called, from Nevada, just prior to the election in November 2016, kind of hotly contested down there in Nevada. I quote Mr. Heller, "The repeal of this law will not only reduce federal spending, but it will also allow Congress to address problems within the current health care system," unquote. Mr. Heller voted against repeal, folks. Shelley Moore Capito, Republican, West Virginia. Remember, this is a state that Donald Trump carried by, like, you know, 50%. I mean, it wasn't even, like, in the ballpark. And it's the state, if you remember, he just had his big rally in, I think, what was it, night before last. Quote, this is right before the 2016 election. I have consistently voted to repeal and replace this disastrous health care law, and I am glad that a repeal bill will finally reach the president's desk. She voted against the repeal, folks. Lamar Alexander, I'm kind of disappointed in him. Republican, so-called, Tennessee. Before the election, Obamacare was an historic mistake and should be repealed and replaced with step-by-step reforms that transform the healthcare delivery system, unquote. Yep, good old Lamar voted against repeal, folks. Susan Collins, Republican of Maine. Now, Susan Collins is probably the least Republican of any Republican. She was also caught on a hot mic, just as a sidelight, talking with another Republican senator. I think it might have been one of these seven rather not-so-much Republican folks, Rhino folks. She was caught on a hot mic just a week ago. You can Google it up, talking about how the president is crazy, man. He's insane and blah, 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 giggling and laughing like a schoolgirl. Great. Love it. That's just what we need, Susan. Now, in Susan's defense, I'm going to give you both sides of the story. She has always been more of a fan of repairing Obamacare based on her votes than in repealing it. So, anybody who looked at Susan Collins's record would know that she was lying to you when she said right before the election, quote, I believe that Congress made a real error in passing Obamacare. We should repeal the law so that we can start over. Yeah, she voted against repeal, you folks up in Maine. John McCain. Now, I've talked about John McCain ad infinitum. I've warned you that he is, he's really a progressive wearing a Republican lapel pin. And this is a state, kind of like Murkowski's state, where the premiums are through the roof. I think 116% increases in Arizona. Quote, this is before the election, folks, and that was a very tough election for him down there. He almost lost it. It is clear that any serious attempt to improve our healthcare system must begin with a full repeal and replacement of Obamacare, unquote. And as we all know, folks, John McCain voted against repeal. And then we have Rob Portman, who I've never been a big fan of. I don't dislike him, but you know, he's a buddy of John Kasich, who in some ways is a great governor, and in other ways is just, once again, he's one of these guys should have a R in front of his name. So this is Portman before the election. Obamacare is fundamentally flawed. I do think we ought to delay, and then we've got to repeal this thing and start over. Yep, you guessed it. Robbie boy. All you folks out there in Ohio who listen to me, he voted against repeal. So, those are the names, seven folks, what they had to say, and then how they voted. And, folks, if you voted for these folks, if you voted for these rhinos in your particular state, and I got listeners from what my producers and web folks say in all 50 states, some more in some states than others. There's several things you have to do. Support a viable, don't support somebody who's not going to win in the general election because you haven't done anything. Then you've lost at least an R seat, even if it doesn't often vote R in Congress. And any R seat, even these seven rhinos, is usually, for the most part, better than a Dem seat. Because the Democratic Party doesn't exist, folks. It's really the Progressive Party. But if there is a viable candidate that goes up against these folks that can win in the general election, support that candidate. I mean, these senators really need to kind of go away. They need to go retire, write their books or memoir, whatever they're going to do. So, now you have the rest of the story on the Rhino Republicans and Obamacare. Now, for the meat of the matter, the meat of the show, so to speak. So in this week, there has been an incredible barrage of information, dots, communications, FOIA requests, Judicial Watch finally got documents on a FOIA they slapped on the FBI a year ago. And here's and I'm just going to give it to you in bullet points, folks, because this is a developing story. The new special counsel that I believe 70% chance is going to be appointed, and the indictments which will follow, which I believe range from 50 to 80%, assuming the special counsel gets installed, of corrupt Democratic politicians and bureaucrats, is going to be predicated among many things. And these are just straight facts. I think Benghazi is going to get in the fray. A year ago, Judicial Watch slapped the FBI with a FOIA request. And it was broad and all-encompassing. It said any and all, which in legal terms means the max, right? You can't do more than any and all. Any and all documents that relate to or pertain to Loretta Lynch's tarmac meeting with Bill Clinton. They slapped the FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, which, by the way, is supposed to be responded to in 30 days under federal law, on the FBI. That was like last July. Guess what? This was like right after the tarmac meeting, where, you know, Bill and Rutter said it was by happen chance. I mean, they just happened to run into each other on the tarmac, and they discussed their grandkids and the golf game, and that's all there was, blah, blah, blah. In the meantime, if you listen to my shows around that time, you know, more than most Americans do, that they were captured only by an alert local reporter who happened to see Loretta Lynch's plane on the tarmac and Bill Clinton walking up the little gangplank to it. And, in fact, they met for about 45 minutes. That's a long time to discuss grandkids and golf. I don't even think Loretta plays golf, so a very long time for a golf discussion. And they dismissed all their staff from the meeting. So there was no witnesses to this meeting other than Bill Clinton, baby, and Loretta Lynch, the Obama Attorney General, who has disregarded the law and the Constitution on more than one occasion, including this one. Anyway, Judicial Watch slaps a FOIA on the FBI in July of 2016. In October of 2016, this is an amazing set of dots. They get a letter. They get a letter. And by the way, a FOIA request is a legal request. So if you lie in responding to a FOIA request, it is perjury, which is a felony. They get a letter back from the FBI saying, and I quote, "No documents responsive to requests can be located." Okay. You know who it was signed by, folks? James Comey. Yes, the very same James Comey who admitted leaking classified information via his buddy to get a special prosecutor appointed. The same James Comey who did not indict Hillary Clinton, although he delivered a 13-minute sermon on all the laws she broke. The same James Comey who was just not enough of a man. I was too scared. I was too upset to tell the president he shouldn't be saying this. Yeah, that James Comey. He signed the response to Judicial Watch's FOIA request. There, no responsive documents can be located. Huh. So Judicial Watch, being the aggressive bulldogs, and thank God for them, that's another alpha you should give some money to. In fact, I won't do it on this show, but I will post one of their flyers so you can send them 10 or 20 bucks, because those guys do a whale of a job protecting the rights of all of us. Judicial Watch goes to federal court, and the judge goes, what is this nonsense? You, FBI, you will turn over all these documents at once. And the FBI says, but we don't have any documents. So Judicial Watch went to the Department of Justice. They slapped a FOIA request on them. And, of course, the Department of Justice, since while there's still many Obama holdovers which have to be weeded out, the Department of Justice is now run by Jeff Sessions, the AG, the Attorney General. And sure enough, here come the first sets of documents, 420 pages to be exact. And you know what they included? They included, and they all related to this tarmac meeting, they included a whole bunch of interesting stuff. But one of the most interesting things they included was an email from an Obama holdover, no longer there, at the Justice Department, to one James Comey, director of the FBI, saying, what are we going to do about this? What kind of talking points can we develop? So, there were many other emails between other people and or Comey at the FBI and DOJ on this subject. And there was a set of talking points, incredible as this is. I don't think, last time I checked, I don't think the FBI is a political arm of the Democratic Party, or shouldn't be. And the DOJ, even though it is a political arm, or has been a political arm of the Democratic Party, should not be. They arrived at a set of talking points. This is all prior to Comey, and they're all in the emails. I mean, you can't refute it. And there's a number of emails. Like, this 420 pages is mostly emails between DOJ and FBI. And in those emails, although I have not been able to find the content, were emails concerning Benghazi. I told you when Benghazi happened, it was never going to go away. The souls of those poor guys who died on that rooftop waiting for help that Clinton and Obama and Jarrett never sent, they will not rest until the truth comes out. And the truth is going to start to come out, you mark my words, because there's emails in here about the response, the lack of response, I should say, the horrible lack of response in this deal. The FBI, by the way, has also recovered some of Hillary Clinton's deleted 33,000 emails, including some emails about Benghazi. Quite amazing. You're going to see more and more and more of this. So what we have here, folks, we have Director Comey, let me give you some dots, who testifies in front of Congress, a month ago, whenever it was, 2 months ago, that he leaked a felony, that he did not mention any perception of obstruction of justice by Trump in his discussions with Trump. And by the way, if he had and had not reported it back there in February, that's a felony. You're commanded by law when you're a law enforcement officer and an FBI person to report any obstruction of justice by any official in the government. That same James Comey is the guy who signed this FOIA request as having no responsive documents, which obviously was a bald-faced lie, i.e. perjury in this case, because those documents not only existed, have now been turned over by the Justice Department, and there's emails back and forth, including to Mr. Comey. Imagine that. The next thing, next dot I'll give you as to this little tangent of the sordid progressive mess is that talking points were developed. And in the documents produced by the Justice Department, guess what was redacted? Oh, yeah, that's right, the talking points. So Judicial Watch does not yet have the sheet of paper with the talking points that Comey and Lynch and the DOJ and the FBI developed to hide stuff from us, you know, that flyover middle America, red states deal I talked about at the beginning of the show in my stories. The place where I'm signing books. They wanted to make sure we didn't know because, you know, we're stupid. And if they can just hide it, it'll all go away because we're not smart enough to find it. The next thing that happened this week, the next thing that happens this week is that we find out that that meeting from these emails, that meeting between Clinton and Lynch on the tarmac, was anything but an accident. It was completely prearranged. And there are emails between various people discussing about when Clinton was going to be there and when Lynch was going to be there. So, the very nexus of the excuse for the meeting, which was it was happen chance and about golf and grandkids, is now blown out of the water in writing by emails saying that's a big lie. Not that any of us are surprised about that. And then we have this week, we have Debbie Wasserman Schultz, firing this Pakistani guy finally, after he's arrested trying to get out of the country, after he's smashed all the laptops he was working on for Debbie Wasserman Schultz and a bunch of other congresspeople. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. And they're all stowed. Where do you think they're stowed? Oh, yeah. Debbie Wasserman Schultz's garage. The smash laptops. Federal property, I might add. We come to find out that this Pakistani and his family milked the taxpayers for $5 million, including double billings, and likely took information that he had access to because of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, to the mainframe servers and computers of the House Judiciary Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, along with about 15 fairly influential House Democrats, and of course, the DNC. And despite Congress catching on to this and firing he and his brother, and I carried that story back in February and told you it wasn't over, told you much more is going to come out of this. And here it is blowing wide open. The FBI is now, they now have those laptops and they are going to be able to recover a lot of the data. Boy, this is going to get really interesting, folks. And guess what? Trump's new FBI director was appointed the other day. So McCabe, the second in command when Comey was there, this is the guy whose wife took $700,000 in Democratic funding running for an office, I think it was in New Jersey, Mr. McCabe, will no longer be running things. It's going to be really interesting to see how all this comes down. Really interesting. And I've always surmised that the leaks, by the way, I don't think they're in the White House. Oh, there might be, you know, this, that, Kellyanne wore an ugly dress, or, you know, Trump didn't like his coffee. Those kind of leaks, I mean, that's going to happen. But these huge leaks, these leaks that put the nation and you and me and our families at peril, my opinion is, and always has been, you go back and listen to my shows, Type in FBI or CIA. Type in the word Brennan, John Brennan. Listen to those shows. My contention is that the leaks have come from the FBI, the bureaucrats, certain bureaucrats, a limited number of bureaucrats, instigated and kind of overseen by Comey, who we know is a leaker. He's admitted it in sworn testimony. And the CIA, kind of instituted and exhorted, in other words, pushed to occur by John Brennan, our friend John Brennan. I've done a bunch of shows that involve John Brennan. There's lots you need to know, including his likely conversion to Islam in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, I believe in 2009. Gee, right before his appointment by Obama. Oh, no, that must just be a coincidence. And Brennan, by the way, is going to be another one in the crosshairs, and Brennan's another one who could likely get indicted by the new special counsel, which I believe is going to be appointed. And then we find out this week that James Clapper, you know, I've talked about in previous shows how Obama did an executive order that, number one, made elections a national utility, which gives the federal government more control over them. Number two, signed an executive order that expanded who could see this highly classified information, American names and unmasking, all that kind of stuff, from three agencies and a handful of people to 16 agencies and hundreds of people. I've talked about on these shows how White House people under Obama admitted that they were trying to gather all the information they could so they could disseminate it later to the American people, so the American people would know the truth. I mean, make me wretch. These people would know how to spell the word truth. And we know that Susan Rice was involved in the unmasking, the felonious unmasking of General Flynn. And we come to find out this week also that Samantha Powers, who I talked about last week as having been involved in some of the unmasking, was actually involved in hundreds of illegal unmaskings of American citizens caught up in surveillance of foreign operatives. Hundreds of names. Now, she's the ambassador to the United Nations, folks. I'm not sure she should even have access to the raw intelligence data. I mean, her job is to go up there and make the right speech, period. But to have Susan Powers, the very first UN ambassador in history, to ask for unmasking of American citizens that are being unwittingly surveilled in legal surveillances of foreign operatives, she asked for hundreds of names to be unveiled. Now, so the question is why, and then what did she do with that information? I think we all kind of know what the answers are going to be, don't we? And then the next thing which happened this week is that Wasserman Schultz, you know, you have this IT administrator, Pakistan Imran Alam, whose family had already fled with $5 million of our tax dollars. We find out that after the congressman caught him stealing data, which now also this week, more information, it is assumed was given to enemies of the United States, or should we say, quote-unquote, allies of the United States who wanted certain types of intelligence, we learned that he had access not only to the computers of these 15 or 16 congressmen, the DNC and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, he also had access to the mainframe servers, computers, slash whatevers, for the House Judiciary Committee and the House Intelligence Committee. You know, where classified information is talked about in secret, as it should be. And the fear now, also coming out this week, is that he transmitted all that information, or the juicy information, up to some cloud-type thing, where it was not only stored, but could be accessed by his masters, whoever they happen to be. I don't know whether it's Russia or Pakistan or some other country. I told you last week it was uncovered. He got a $100,000 payment for something from Iraq. And we come to learn this week that although he lost his computer security clearance, in other words, he could no longer access the stuff in Congress in February after they caught him double billing and some other nasty stuff, Debbie Wasserman Schultz kept him on the American taxpayer payroll at rates higher than any other IT analyst, and had him do gopher jobs and keep her printers running. In other words, he didn't show up for work. Instead, he got paid $160,000 of our money to just kind of breathe. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz did not fire him. In the meantime, she's interfered with the investigation into these computers, threatened Capitol Police, and all sorts of other stuff. I'm not going to go there today. But she did absolutely keep him around using our taxpayer dollars and did not fire him until the day after he was arrested at Dulles International Airport trying to hop on a plane with Pakistan with a bunch of money. And after he smashed all the laptop computers, which were conveniently stored in Debbie Wasserman's garage. In other words, she knew all about it, folks. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz came out yesterday and had the audacity to say she did it for all the right reasons. She can now look herself in the mirror. And the only reason this is all coming up is that he's black and he's Muslim. Oh, my God, make me wretch. Now, apparently there's also been emails uncovered on Clinton Foundation stuff. And it's quite apparent that Mueller does not intend to spend any time on this stuff. He's on his witch hunt with his 8 top staff members being Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, contributors to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. Every one of his higher-up attorneys, folks, is a Democrat who has contributed to Democratic causes, including Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. So, I think we know where Mueller isn't going, and I think we know where he would like to go. Not that I think he'll get there. And the last thing we hear is that Mueller impaneled a grand jury this week. I don't know if that's true or not. There's a lot of fake news around. And a grand jury, of course, is a prosecutor's greatest ally. Because the defense is not there. They can submit any crapola they want to the grand jury to try and get an indictment of, you know, Joe Schmo, Bob Blue, whatever, Sally Lou. So it's a big weapon. Gives them broader subpoena powers and a whole bunch of other things. So that is quite a bevy of dots, don't you think? Yes, quite a bevy of dots. Now, we have a new FBI director who I think will weed out any deep state actors there. By the way, let me tell you that right underneath this audio bar should be, I'm not going to be able to check it because I'll be signing books, a link to the show I was talking about on the deep state 2 years ago. I think it would be well worth your while when you have a chance to click on that link and listen to that show from 2 years ago about the deep state that I was warning of, that I was bringing to your attention then. I mean, the words deep state have like hardly ever been used. And to compare with what you are seeing play out now. And I think you'll agree that 2 years ago I was right on track. Unfortunately. Very unfortunately. by the way, the Benghazi emails, it seems, go several steps further. Once again, nobody's talking about them yet. Because the report that was issued, if you will, about Benghazi by Congress, although it kind of let Hillary off the hook, I mean, Republicans, what are you doing? The report severely criticized military, CIA, and the Obama administration for their response as the attacks were unfolding over there in Benghazi, and their subsequent blatant lies to the American public and the press, not that the press cares much. That report also accused the government of incompetence, failure to deploy needed military assets, CIA intelligence being rife with errors, and misguided planning. So we now have Dems kind of in a panic. We got the second special counsel coming down. We got all these goodies coming out. We, of course, have the collusive mainstream media barely talking about this, if they're talking about it at all. Quite an interesting turn of events. And last but not least, we find out this week, and this was stunning. So McMaster's, as you know, General McMaster's is the national security advisor to Donald Trump. We find out this week that Ms. McMaster's, this is in the middle of investigation after Susan Rice has been caught lying about her role in unmasking three times. Originally, she knew nothing about it. Secondly, she was involved in it, but only at a minimal amount and also only for national security purposes. And thirdly, I forget what thirdly is because she lies so much, can't remember them all. You have the gist. You have the gist. So this woman, kind of like Hillary Clinton, did you know Hillary Clinton still has her security clearance, folks? Does that make you feel good? So Hillary Clinton, where's that article? Let me thumb through the papers here. Okay, here we go. I want you to listen to this. All right, so McMaster's actually writes a waiver letter for Susan Rice in the middle of all this stuff coming down, giving her access to all the confidential information at her same previous confidential and classified need-to-know information level, which was like right up there just below Obama's. Now, why would McMaster's do something like that? I don't know. Here's a portion of his letter. By the way, pursuant to Section 4.4 of Executive Order 13526, access by historical researchers and certain former government personnel, I hereby waive the requirement that you must have a need to know to access any classified information contained in items you originated, reviewed, signed, or received while serving as a National Security Advisor. So, let me keep going here. I hereby waive the requirement that you must have a need to know to access any classified information contained in items you originated, reviewed, signed, or received while serving as National Security Advisor. This decision is based on my determination, number one, that such access is consistent with the national security interests of the United States. Wow. Unbelievable. And two, that appropriate steps have been taken to protect the classified information from unauthorized disclosure, that would be a leak, folks, or compromise, and to ensure that the information you access is safeguarded in a manner consistent with EO 13526. Signed, W.R. McMaster, Lieutenant General, United States Army, Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. To the Honorable, folks, Susan E. Rice. Now, that strikes me as a little bizarre, doesn't it? That strikes me as just a tad bizarre. The woman who was involved in all these scandals, lies, and incorrect security determinations, assumptions, decisions, and lack of decisions, who has lied about unmasking on three occasions before finally admitting it and trying to find an excuse, and is now under investigation by at least the House Judiciary Committee. Don't you find it a little odd that the National Security Advisor would allow her to keep her classified clearance? I find it very odd. Now, what all these dots mean is that the odds of the special counsel for these types of matters, we'll call it the Democratic special counsel, i.e. focusing on the Democrats, Mueller being the Republican special counsel, i.e. focusing on the Republicans, the odds just went up of his or her appointment. You betcha. You bet they did. Oh, yes, I forgot to tell you. And this letter from McMaster's to Rice comes at a time when Rice, who originally, I reported this 2 weeks ago, who originally agreed to testify before Congress, said no. And Rice was then subpoenaed, and Rice then took the documents that the subpoena requested and has attempted to donate them to the Obama Library, not even built yet, but planned for Chicago, Illinois, because that puts them off limits under federal law for another 5 years. We can't see the documents pertaining to the unmasking. But McMaster's allowed her to keep her security clearance. Like I said, I find this remarkable. What all this stuff means, I'm going to put together for you and bring to you next week. And next week, with a little luck, I'm going to have, I can't promise because I'm only partially done with the research, I'm going to have that show I have promised for several weeks on the top 10 states most likely to go bankrupt. But before they do, most likely to raise your taxes through the roof because they'll be so desperate for money. So that is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio for this Saturday, August, what is it, the 5th? I think it's the 5th today. August 5th, folks, 2017. There's lots bubbling along. But more than anything, do an act of kindness for somebody when you have an opportunity. You'd be amazing how little things make you feel good and make them feel good. And that, folks, in its own little way, makes America feel good. We'll talk to you next week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.